Can I have your attention, please? Thank you. This week is International Water Week, and that was part of the inspiration for the timing of this conference. Oh, it's the reverse. Sorry, Lily was advising. Your next keynote speaker is David Schindler. I do recommend you to read his bio in the program, and you will see that he is most extraordinarily distinguished and recognized water scientist. He's in fact the dean of water scientists, certainly in Canada, most definitely in North America, and some argue, I think very justifiably, the dean of the world's water scientists. So we're very privileged to have him here. But he's not just a water scientist. He distinguishes himself by connecting water science to policy, to action. And he does it at all levels, from the grassroots to the national and the global level. He has an extraordinary reputation, and he's been extraordinarily successful in that regard for many years. It is my privilege to introduce Dr. Shen.
Well, thank you, Bob. The title I have up here is what I was asked to talk about. And for a backdrop, I have a shot of the Precambrian Shield and the boreal forest the way it was 40 years ago. You'd be hard-pressed to find a shot like that today. There would be lines running through it and little clear cuts on it and well pads and things almost anywhere you'd go in Canada. So this is intended as a bit of a reminder. We talk about all the water that Canada has, but we often don't talk about where it is. 60% of it is in the boreal forest, mostly in the Precambrian Shield or along the crack between the Precambrian Shield and other parts. 20% of the world's supply alone is in Lake Superior. And globally, almost 60% of the standing water I'm talking about now is in the boreal. We have another 20% in Lake Baikal alone, so it gives you an idea. These are just the lakes over 10 square kilometers in area. As a percentage of surface area, the darkest blues here are up to 40% of the area covered by water. And if you want to see what a 40% coverage looks like, this is a province that most people think is very dry. This is Saskatchewan, but it's the Lac La Ronge area just north of the Plains Precambrian boundary. And as you can see, there's almost as much water as land by surface area. But that isn't all of the water. It's also a lot in wetlands. And some of these wetland areas, the darkest blues here, are up to 100% wetland cover for those parts of the boreal. So as you can see, a good part of the Mackenzie Valley and the Hudson's Bay lowlands are 50% or more wetland. And of course, that's an important capacitor. Rain that falls on that seeps slowly into lakes and rivers, so it means that we're not getting these sorts of flash floods that we see happening in the Red River Basin all the time, where people have destroyed the wetlands and channelized everything. So they're an important part of the landscape. Tragically, the southern and western part of the boreal are being nibbled. This isn't mountain pine beetle. This is Homo sapiens. The green and the yellow are where humans have been invading the boreal. The good news side, of course, is in the north and east, where there's still a lot of untouched boreal. But I would have said the same in the south when I started working in the boreal 45 years ago. There was hardly a road anywhere, and most of the people in industry that I talked to told me, for example, that the trees were not marketable. They just weren't big enough, and they wouldn't make good pulp because they were too gnarly and nobody could make pulp out of poplar and things like that. Well, a lot has changed in 40 years. Most recently, we have doubled the carbon budget for the boreal forest. Over the years, the boreal went from not being recognized at all for carbon storage to being recognized by about 10 years ago as being as important as the temperate and tropical forests put together. The reason it wasn't recognized earlier is that most of the carbon is not in the trees. It's in the forest floor. And I believe it was 1991 when Evel Gorham pointed out that the average depth of peat in the boreal was between 2 and 3 meters, with some places as deep as 10. And all of that laid down over 7 to 10,000 years, depending on where you are, by dry weight is about 50% carbon. Well, just late last year, for the first time, people actually measured the carbon that's in permafrost, about half of it under the boreal. And unfortunately, they didn't distinguish in these studies between the boreal and the tundra zones. But together, the permafrost soils contained 1,672 pentagrams of carbon. It's 50% of the global below-ground carbon. And there are several papers in the last several years that indicate that some of that permafrost is melting, releasing both the carbon as both methane and CO2, and, of course, the water flowing into nearby systems. Well, to put all of that in some economic perspective, this ecosystem service concept has been around for quite a few years, but not very fashionable. In the last 5 years or so, it's become so fashionable that there have been 3 or 4 conferences this year alone solely devoted to it. This study was done by Mark Anielski and Sarah Wilson, indicating that the boreal ecosystem services are worth $703 billion. Of that, the biggest value is carbon storage, which they calculated based on the sorts of monetary values that people are using for trading carbon and so on. About $100 million was various flood control and water filtration functions, which is a combination of things that go on in the watershed. And I think one mistake that we're still making all the time as we talk about protecting waters, if you are not protecting the watershed, you're not protecting water. Down here you can see that recreational values and nature-related activities, they've put a price on too. And I would argue that there's some spiritual values and things that are priceless and you can't put a control on them. Well, by comparison, this is what we're getting out of the boreal by ripping it up. Timber, mining and oil and gas, and hydroelectric generation being the big ones, but we're paying for them by this pack of costs, which they reckon have decreased the value of the ecosystem services by about 15%, low as the areas impacted are. So the net value is only about $50 billion. In other words, the ecosystem services are worth about 14 times more than the value that we're getting out of mining and logging and hydro generation. And I don't know how accurate those figures are, but I would certainly believe that those ecosystem services are more value than the resource exploitation ones. We talk a lot about carbon storage, and people now, with our politicians still fiddling, not doing anything about global warming, scenarios are beginning to crop up of runaway global warming. What happens when the methane hydrates in the coastal oceans melt and the permafrost melts, discharging all of its carbon, as I mentioned, and mountain pine beetle kills all of the pine in the boreal forests and then they burn. In Canada alone, forest fires have doubled in the last 30 years, and in a bad fire year, they emit as much carbon as our industry does. But this was the accepted number in 2007, the 700, this publication from the Woods Hole Research Center. You can see that it's much bigger than the tropical and temperate forests put together. 1,500 question mark is what I reckon is likely to be the figure once we add in that new estimate, the boreal proportion of that new estimate of permafrost carbon. So in that paper, Charles Turnicai is a Canadian scientist who led this effort and has been a leader in soil science for on the order of 40 years. Well, I've heard several people mention how much water we have here. We have a lot of water standing on the landscape, but in renewable water, we don't look so good. We heard about how scarce water is in China. Well, the true measure of sustainable water that we can use without depleting our resources is measured as runoff in a year. So these are annual runoff. You can see we're about half of Brazil or the Soviet Union. And the reason we have a lot of water standing around is that we're a cool country. We have a lot of very little evaporation, a lot of snow that runs in, and our water bodies are covered by ice for half to three-quarters of the year. And that's going to change. You can see the same thing in other figures here. The darkest two blue colors are in millimeters of runoff, less than 50 for that very dark patch in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and 50 to 100 millimeters for the next blue bar. Notice that that's about half of that boreal zone. Alberta, ironically, the worst province that there is, I think, in terms of squandering water, has the poorest supply. We have 7% of the land area and produce 2% of the Canadian runoff, and still we act as though we have abundant water. Water and the effects of climate warming on it are going to affect almost everything we do. We can't just look at water and water supplies. We have to look at the combined effects of various things that we're doing to the watershed and the water in each of these basins. And I've given you two examples here of basins that I think are in trouble for one reason or another, and the big four in both cases that are going to possibly affect them. I'll go into more detail on those in a few minutes. Another indicator of some things we have to deal with is there's increasing evidence that the time we think of as normal, the 20th century, which is largely when Europeans arrived with measuring instruments, was an unusually wet century, and yet we consider that to be normal. There's a number of interesting examples. This is Holocene evolution of Lake Winnipeg and Lake Manitoba and Winnipegosis. And you can see that there were times as recently as 4,000 years ago that those were closed basins. Once a basin has no outflow, it gets saline very, very rapidly. And you can see they were much smaller. There are actually grass layers in the sediments of those lakes. There were more buffalo pastures than there were lakes in that area. But a recent study, I think rather cleverly, deduced what the climate was like around that lake by taking those same lake sediments and dating them and looking at the fossils that were in them of terrestrial plants and then matching them to contemporary communities. And the community that 4,000 to 7,000 years ago best fit Lake Winnipeg in terms of fossils was the community around Medicine Hat, particularly in the early years of this century when, if you're a Westerner, you know the highest human populations were in the 20s, and most of them literally blew away in the dirty 30s, and they've never recovered since. So Manitoba was that dry a few centuries ago. And if you think that the East escaped, this is another study by the same group. The yellow lines here on the Great Lakes indicate the extent of the Great Lakes in the mid-Holocene. They were also closed basins, and some of them were becoming rapidly saline, particularly the ones with that had most of their drainage outside the Precambrian shield. And some of them were becoming quite eutrophic because they retained all of the nutrients that went into them. And this is reckoned to have been a time that was actually about 1 degree cooler, again by deducing from the flora around it. And it's thought that probably it was just a slight change in the prevailing wind directions. A lot of the moisture in this basin in the 20th century came from air masses moving up off the Gulf of Mexico. And it's thought that during this past time, the preponderance came straight from the west, which are much more arid than those coming up from the Gulf. Well, a lot of this was deduced from things like tree rings. A group at the University of Saskatchewan, headed by Dave Sochin, deduced that in the 20th century, trees like poplar on the little islands like the Cypress Hills that stick up out of the prairies. In dry years, the poplar laid down very thin rings, and in wet years, they were very broad, and they got a very good calibration in the 20th century, and then assumed that they could go back in time by using older wood as an index of how wet it was. And this is from one of their studies, this one for southwestern Saskatchewan, southeastern Alberta, this one for adjacent Montana. On these, the yellow lines are droughts, and the red lines are droughts that were over 10 years long. This is the Dirty 30s, so you can see that the Dirty 30s, by historical standards, were a pretty puny period of drought, and yet those who were here think it was a horrible period of drought. And even the droughts just at the turn of this century, 2001 to 2003, I think the cumulative drought meant that the biggest damage was done in 2003. We paid out $2 billion in farm aid that year. In most people's minds, that's a crisis, and yet they object when you talk about climate warming as a drought, as a crisis. So we have to, I think, expect that we're going to see some drought in the near future, the next couple of hundred years at least. There are other studies similar in logic done with diatoms, which have silicon frustules like this that are, you can identify the species. When the diatom dies, these fall into the lake sediments and they're preserved in the layers that were laid down in a particular year. And they're very salinity sensitive. So by analyzing the diatom community in an individual stratum, you can tell how saline the lake was. And of course, lakes get more saline as the basins close and the water levels drop. This, in part, explains what's puzzled historians for a long time, why John Palliser, Dirty Mouth, the southern part of that region, the same area that I've been talking about in southern Saskatchewan and Alberta, and 20 years later, John McCoon came along and thought it was a really lush area. McCoon was a botanist, and Palliser arrived late in about a 30-year period of drought, and McCoon arrived after the drought had broken about 10 years before. So explains a lot about these things that used to puzzle historians. Well, superimposed on that drought, we have greenhouse warming. And this big picture is to remind you that the global figures that the media report all of the time are heavily skewed to what's happening in the oceans. They keep telling us that we're around a degree. Well, look at the area that's a degree. If you look up here in the north and the northern part of the landmass, it's 2 to 4 degrees already. And you can see what's happening by mid-century here. And I think we're going to be very close to this, because I have no faith in politicians to do anything about this problem whatsoever. 4 times CO2, we're 6 degrees warmer down at this latitude, and we're going to be in deep doo-doo. Well, the climate deniers talk about this is all natural. Well, if you fit all of the natural things that they talk about to the climate warming models, you come up with something like the gray line here. And this is what the real temperature data show, the red line. If you put in the human factors alone, you miss out in this area, so it's not perfect either. You put both of them together and you get a pretty good replication of what's actually happened. And this is an actual run. So when the climate deniers say that people aren't putting these factors in, they're not telling the truth. They're certainly not perfect, but they're doing the best job they can of counting for the natural factors as well. So in a place like Alberta, which has very little water except what comes out of the mountains, the average evaporation is 400 to 450 millimeters, and down here we only have 300 to 350 of millimeters of precipitation, and that's the mid-20th century was a pretty wet period. You can see that if there weren't water running in the aquifers and streams out of the Rockies, it would be pretty dry in that part of Alberta. We did some studies of how temperature changed a few years ago. These are the figures we came up with. These are for sites that we don't think are affected by urban heat islands. For example, Edmonton is Edmonton International. It's not Edmonton downtown. Calgary's a splice of downtown and Calgary International. Fort Chipewyan is 1,000 people, and the airport is 10 miles out of town, and so forth. And you can see, and I can show you more figures, but it'd be dizzying to show that the range is about 2 to 4 degrees Celsius already since 1970. And we got the Climate Center at Victoria to model the potential increases, and the mean is represented by the hard line here. And the Canadian Prairie region, they reckon, is going to be about 6.5 degrees warmer by the end of this century than it was in the mid-20th century. Well, of course, emails changed all of that. I think, is pretty indicative of the stupidity of this argument. They hacked a half dozen key emails out of about 3,000 that they think told something. There's some stories behind some of those emails. They're taken totally out of context, but I don't have time to go into them here. But what I'd like to point out is that people can see with their own eyes. You can go on Google Earth and see what's happening to the Arctic ice packs, and you can go to the Rocky Mountains and see what's happening to the glaciers, and you can look at lake levels of the lakes you go to and so on and see what's happening. So I don't think people are really as stupid as the climate deniers think. But what I think people like is comfort. They don't like to worry about the fact that their politicians aren't doing anything, and we're seeing some buy into this, as indicated by all of the Twitter that you see going on the Internet and so on. Here's one indicator. If you're from Saskatchewan or eastern Alberta, this is what the lakes are doing. This is some of Environment Canada's records that were put together as part of the park project, which included the Saskatchewan people that I mentioned as well. Each one of those little bars is 2 meters, so you can see some of those lakes have dropped 4 to 6 meters. And the rivers, I'm going to show you one example for this heavily subscribed basin. This is the South Saskatchewan Basin. And the one I'll show you is the middle one here. This is the Bow River Basin, which is one of the most heavily subscribed in the West. Starts at this glacier, This is what that glacier looked like in 1897 when a British chemist, who was an excellent photographer and did a lot of fiddling with the chemistry of photography to improve it. In fact, he claims he invented color photography, had some photos in the White Museum, and Graham Pohl, who was writing a hiking book and wanted to illustrate it, went back to this site in 2002, 105 years later. The tree hasn't hit the ground yet. Same tree. Look at what's happened to the glacier. And some hydrologists will tell you these glaciers are inconsequential because they're only about 3% of the annual flow. But if you look at a dry year in the summer, the snow is all melted by the middle of June or thereabouts. And if there's very little rainfall in July and August, at the Banff Park boundary, 50% of the water can be glacial melt. Remember, there's five species of fish in that stream that are right at their thermal limits, too. So this is also cold water. And the glaciologists who work on this say that this glacier's over the hill. Doesn't matter if it warms more, it can't produce more water. So this source is all but gone. Then the river comes down this little crack right here. The big crack is the Columbia on the west side. And it turns the corner here near Banff, and it comes out of the mountains here. And this area that looks like it was sprayed with ancient orange is Calgary. So that's the first major insult. This is the growth of Calgary by area in the 20th century. And if it is growing at the same rate for the next 50 years as it has for the last 50, that'll be the area. And if you know that area, it's already well on its way to Cochrane. You can see Calgary coming. And if you stand there long enough, you can see the boundary actually moving as you're standing there. And then you get just below Calgary, and you get into irrigation country. And the Old Man supplies about half the water, the tributary just to the south of the bow, but about half the water from that irrigation demand comes out of the Bow River right near Bassano, just downstream of Calgary. And when you get below where the irrigation water's taken, there's almost nothing that goes over the dam in a dry summer. And there's fish kills due to either warm water or low oxygen in some years already. Well, if you put all of the insults to those three basins, the Red Deer, the Bow, and the Old Man together, measure the flow in the South Saskatchewan. This is summer flows in May through August, which is the period that people demand water for irrigating and watering lawns, and the fish are most vulnerable and so forth. You can see what the decline has been over a period of time. Also remember that this represents all of the upstream reservoirs that are filling. We have a whole string of hydroelectric reservoirs on that system that were never subjected to an environmental impact assessment. They were all put in the late 30s and early 40s under the War Measures Act, and they just sent an engineer in who sketched something on a paper bag and handed it to the bulldozer operators and said, build this, and they did. Well, those same stretches of river are not in very good shape. 31 reaches were studied by Alberta Environment, and the only two that were unchanged or recovered are these two. The recovered one is the Old Man below Lethbridge. The unchanged one, I think, is the upper bow in Banff National Park. All of the rest are moderately to heavily impacted. And small wonder with a city like Calgary discharging, but also a huge agricultural operation, both irrigation, which if you look at the analyses of return flow, the water quality is not very high. And remember, we have places like Feedlot Alley and so forth in this area. This is Statistics Canada manure map of Canada, and you can see the real Alberta advantage right here. So This is where it comes from, all of these big operations, up to 40,000 head of cattle. There is a bright side of this. 10 years ago, the Klein government projected that they would have 12 million cattle in this area. And we should thank BSE and a few other things. It's pretty well flatlined. The reason we should be thankful is this reflects directly the nutrient input to the river. We have a crazy situation where we have about 3 million humans, and of them, over half get all of the phosphorus, the key element causing algal blooms and that, removed from their excrement. But in terms of beef cattle and hogs, which put out in phosphorus units 10 to 11 times per capita more, you sum all of those up and there's 87 million virtual humans on that landscape. And for 84 million of them, we just tell them, just go out and do it on the land somewhere. So pretty crazy. And you can imagine if that were 170 million, which it could well have been, what sort of state the water would be in by now. We also have the fastest growing population in Canada. Canada as a whole is 6X, Saskatchewan 11X in the last century, and Alberta 44-fold. So small wonder we're getting some problems, and as a result, you look at the industrial activity in Alberta as indicated by lights, and you can see it looks more like the eastern U.S. than anywhere else in Canada. So I want to look at another river basin because I think from a scientific standpoint it's another major worry. And it's another western river, the Athabasca. This is the one that you see if you drive down the Ice Seals Parkway in Jasper National Park. 1919 and 1993, these are the same photos that Parks Canada has hanging in the Ice Field Center, which is right here. It couldn't have been built in 1919. And, of course, they've pounded in a sign every few years as the glaciers retreated. And so we have pretty good documentation. It's retreated just in aerial extent, about a kilometer and a half, and it's thinned quite a bit, too. Well, this is the river that it flows into, and every red star here is a measuring station, with most of them with long-term records. So the 30-year period beginning when we started to see that upward trend in temperature develop strongly looks like this. This is the 71 to 5 average. If you average the last 5 years, looks like this. And if you add the Sunwapta station, it looks like this. The reason that one's high is that Sunwapta is right below the Athabasca Glacier. There's almost no runoff into that basin except for glacial melt. Carries over to this station just below Jasper. But you can see the flatlands of Alberta, and the oil sands occur between this station and this station. We're getting a lot less runoff. So that plus the tar sands are really doing a number on that river basin. The red area on here and the little white speck in the middle are about the size of the country of Greece. I think if you went to the European Union and said, oh, well, we need the petrochemicals under Greece. We're going to dig it up. Somebody might object, but they don't object in Alberta. I don't understand. Anyhow, the oil sands are right in this area. This is the lower river. It flows north, and this is Fort McMurray. Above Fort McMurray, almost nothing happens. A few pulp mills, a few towns of 1,000 to 5,000 people putting their effluents in, and that's about it. This is the hot spot, and, of course, down here you have about 1,500 to 3,000 Aboriginal people living on the landscape. These are the projected amounts of water that the companies that have already been approved can take out of the river. As a rule of thumb, 2 to 3 cubic meters per second per company. So about 14, and you could probably add one to two more for the in situ, the water taken to pump underground as steam for the SAGD, as they're called, for steam-assisted gravity. And if you look at the allocated water use, it's pretty big, and they claim they don't use all of it, but this is what they actually use. AMEC is the company that supplies Alberta Environment with its figures. Of that 414,000 actually used, 8% went back in the river. The rest is too polluted, so it's put in the tailings Great Lakes. The flow in that stretch of the river has been going down. And if you read some of the propaganda that's been coming out in the National Post and other papers, they're talking about this dotted line. That's the average for this period of record. If you look at the trend in the period of record, it's something else. The slope downhill is about 1.5 cubic meters per second. Normally, you wouldn't extrapolate it out this way, but this flow is measured above the oil sands. And the oil sands use is only going to take it in that direction. So I think it's fair to say that that has a good chance of being a very conservative estimate. Well, the area that they're digging up looks much like this. 56% of it is wetland, and a good part of that is wooded fen. There are about 300 species of plants in this area, and some of it's quite beautiful. This is the picture of a string fen that National Geographic had on the cover of last year's issue on the oil sands, and National Geographic has the reputation of being a very business-friendly periodical. And they got royal treatment and shown all over the place by both the companies and the Alberta government. So people were a little bit shocked when their cover photo was this. And the government, to say the least, was a little bit outraged. And this was the cartoon on the front of the Edmonton Journal the week that the government reacted to it. And the statement, and this was right from the premier, is we need to get the message out. And they called in to get the message out what I call the Sunshine Boys. This is what they used to call Sunshine Boys in my hometown in the bars. For the most part, people who lived in the town that sold them were selling Edsels or Studebakers. And they were putting the best fakes on a very bad product. They had a little ruder language to describe this, but it's applied to the oil sands. Usually they think the public is about as smart as a turnip. So some of the stuff they do, I think, is downright insulting. But this is the sort of effect that they have. Here's what's happening in the oil sands. Big companies pumping sunshine into politicians' ears and the ears of the general public if they'll let them do it. Here's one I want to focus on. This was in the Edmonton Journal, and I assume all the other CanWest newspapers. They had this series that were full page called Mythbusters. And the myth perpetuated on the public by the nasty environmental groups was that shale oil sands are polluting the Athabasca River. Somehow the answer seems to disregard the fact that these companies are reporting to Environment Canada's National Pollutant Survey that they are polluting the Athabasca River. And instead, they tell the public, Shell ensures its operations don't add a drop to that. We contain all the processed water and rainwater on our sites to make sure they don't flow into the river. All of it's supposed to be coming from these little natural seeps like this, which is about the size of a small spring. And I've seen three or four of these canoeing down the river. But if you work in watersheds and their interaction with waters, it defies credibility to think that you can do this to a landscape or this to a riverbank. This is the Athabasca River. This little flimsy plastic barrier is all that there is between that stripped hillside and the river, that nothing is getting into the river.
So we decided to do our own study. All of these BS claims are based on the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program, which is carried out by industry. And not to go into detail, it's incompetent. So what we did is to first GIS map the extent of the McMurray Formation, which contains all of the bitumen, and then we went to from the Athabasca between upstream of McMurray and Two Fort Chip. We sampled above and below every industry on the main stem, and on every tributary we sampled above the McMurray Formation, in the McMurray Formation, and below industry, with two rivers having no development on them at all. And we also sampled snowpack at 31 sites. And if you're within 50 kilometers of those plants, this is what the snow looks like when you take an annual section. This represents snowfall for December, January, February, and March. When you filter the snow through white filters, this is 900 milliliters per sample. And to orient you, this is the McMurray end. This is flowing north to Fort Chip. The yellow numbers are distance between the sites in kilometers. The location of the various tar sands facilities are in red. The communities are in blue. Batu Mount isn't a community. It's an abandoned small laboratory where they did the first oil sands work. Fort Mackay is a Chippewyan and Cree village, which has disastrous air quality. They had a couple of evacuations just last week. But you can see as you move down these tributaries, and if you move away from the industry, suddenly these particulates deposited in the snow drop off. This next series of slides, I've got one other. After filtering the melted snow, the filtrate looked like this. It had an oil scum on the top, usually within 50 kilometers of the plant. And then as you move, and these are from Fort McMurray to Fort Chippewyan, you can see them listed over here, AR6 is where the two upgraders are located that upgrade this bitumen to synthetic crude oil. And on these bars, the total bar is the total amount. The red is dissolved and the black is what's in the particulates. And for these, it's upstream of the McMurray Formation and in the McMurray Formation. In some cases, the parts that we had thought were undeveloped based on 2006 GIS maps were actually developed by 2008 when we did the actual sampling. Like that one, but you can see in as you come downstream, when you get below industry, what happens. And you can see what happens. This is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We found about 25 of them in the river, about 9 known carcinogens, including benzoapyrene, the one that you're probably familiar with because it's the main carcinogen in cigarette smoke. There are a few that, because they're in higher concentrations, are more toxic, but you can see there's a fair amount getting into the river. This is in the snowpack lying on the ice, and trace metals the same. Here's lead, much the same pattern. Here's arsenic. Here's mercury. And I could show you 28 other metals, but I won't. They all have much the same pattern. And when you look in the river water rather than in the snow, again, this is the same logic from upstream to downstream. You can see this is winter on that side and summer over here. And the gray and the black are top of water column in the river and below the bottom of the water column. And these are the summary of coming downriver on those tributaries, and the same patterns for trace metals, except that note in the river, this is upstream, this is in the developed area, this is downstream of development and in the Athabasca Delta, this is Lake Athabasca. They don't drop back to normal. So my conclusion is Section 36, subsection 3 of the Fisheries Act, which forbids discharge of deleterious substances into the Athabasca rivers, being violated. You have to ask, where's Environment Canada? They're responsible for this enforcement of that section of the Fisheries Act. It's right on their website. Then there's the issues of the tar ponds, and I won't say as much about those because Syncrude is advertising those pretty well right now with their famous duck episode, which is in the papers every night with pictures like this. They could teach Greenpeace a few tricks about bad publicity. But there is some seepage through these dikes despite their denial. It's funny, they deny it publicly, and then their engineers go off to professional conferences, and they talk about how much leakage there is. So I've seen two presentations like that in the last 2 years. This is a shot from the air. This is 100 meters high. Gives you an idea of the extent of these things. They total 130 square kilometers at this point. That's not a tailings pond anymore. That's a tailings Great Lake. And these things do break. 2 years ago, as a class project, I put four graduate students on to looking at the incidence of tailings pond breakages as a term project. They found 184 cases in the last 25 years. This one had a nice photo, so I stole it from them. This is the Los Frailes mine in Spain. And this is the Rio Agrio, which is where it went. And just some comparative statistics. That pond was 160 hectares. It contained 15 million cubic meters. And to clean up the 5,000 hectares that stuff covered cost $37 million. Well, Mildred Lake's a little bit bigger. Its volume is 400 million cubic meters, not 15. And it leaks 11 million cubic meters a day by their own admission. So you can imagine if one of those dikes let go. And the worst scenario would be if it happened in the winter, because there's no known way to get these compounds out of the river. Summer, you'd put out some booms and slurp the stuff up, and you'd be able to recover probably 70-80% of it. Can't do that in winter, and they've already had one example. They had a small spill in 1982 in January. By March, it was in Lake Athabasca, and it closed the fishery in at least that western end for 2 years. So if one of these big tailings ponds broke in the wintertime, that stuff would be in the Mackenzie River and certainly in Great Slave Lake before they could do anything about cleaning it up. Well, I talked before about effects on the boreal, and we're always put all this sunshine, and I think this is where the media are not really doing a complete job. We're told about this marvelous Mackenzie pipeline that should be built, and industry agrees it should be built, and oh, they talk about all the money it'll bring in. This is current damage to the boreal done by oil and gas activity, including all the stuff I've showed you. This is Global Forest Watch's projection based on scenarios from the oil and gas industry. It isn't just a little pipeline that goes down the valley. They take hydroelectric power to run it from places like the rapids on the Great Bear River and on the Mackenzie. They hook in little deposits that are well off to the side into the pipeline. Roads go along there to help service the thing and so on. And pipelines to all the way to the U.S. to get the stuff to markets. So I think we have to act now to protect the boreal. Just to move east for a little bit, we still have some problems in this area. This is a map turned out by scientists in Quebec and Ontario of the exceedance of the critical load of acid deposition. The media thinks the problem's gone away, at least they've quit covering it, but in fact there's a lot of papers in the last 5 or 6 years that show that there's enough falling to still be eroding the calcium out of forest soils, to the extent that if they're being logged as well as acid rain, there isn't enough calcium left for a second crop. The reason is that while we've cut the sulfur emissions pretty dramatically, about 75% in Canada now and about 60% in the U.S., we've done nothing about nitrogen oxides in this country. So at this point in eastern Ontario, and probably as far east as here, the nitrogen deposition, effectively nitric acid, is equal to the sulfur, and it's still enough to be damaging soils and lakes. Another issue. Also, there's a lot of talk in Ontario and in Alberta about more hydro, and this is cast by the Sunshine Boys again as good green power. This is from the top of the Bennett Dam on the Peace River, which is the one that destroyed the livelihood in Fort Chip, along with climate warming. This is a new map from Global Forest Watch. It's in review right now of the existing hydro sites on rivers. Notice that you don't see many in the west. That's the Bennett Dam I just showed you. Look over here, especially in the James Bay area and in Manitoba. Of course, the Nelson is slowly being developed. These are the projections. Look at some of these lines that you see running across here. Much, much more hydro. And in both Ontario and in BC, there are these green hydro initiatives which look at this from a power perspective, but they don't look at the effect on the watersheds, road access, any terrestrial features or water quality features or fish passage features. So these are disasters already in the making in BC and looming in Ontario, I think, and we need a little broader perspective on those. People cast these as greenhouse gas free. That isn't what the numbers say. If you compare coal, diesel, combined cycle natural gas, photovoltaic, and wind turbines, these are the sorts of ranges of CO2 equivalents per kilowatt hour that you put out. Tropical reservoirs put out just as much as burning coal. These numbers are for the reservoirs like the type we have in Canada, and they're not so bad, but they're not zero. And the reason for this is that when you flood vegetation, especially peat tends to accumulate methane by decomposition until it floats to the surface. Then it discharges methane and CO2 right to the atmosphere. The tropical ones usually discharge from down deep. Down here, things are decaying, producing lots of methane if it's anoxic, and CO2. It's under great pressure because of the water depth, but it's discharged right to the atmosphere. So tremendous degassing in these deep reservoirs with deep discharges. And remember, reservoirs have a lot of other features. I would say they're pretty good on greenhouse gases, but they're not zero, which we should realize. But there's no fish passage in that river. You destroy the whole river channel below a big dam. You pollute all the fish with mercury, and this has been shown in every case I know of in Canada. Lots of displacement of First Nations and the habitat, much of it guaranteed under various treaties of the 19th century. Channel morphology changes downstream. You effectively have a small river running in a big river bed. If you're too far downstream to benefit from the dam, of course, you're out of luck. And migration routes and downstream fishes have no habitat. Another looming project, product of all of what's going on by humans is eutrophication. This is Lake Winnipeg beaches a couple of years ago. This is Lac La Biche in Alberta during a school limnology trip. This is a bloom of blue-green algae. It looks like green paint in the water. blue-green nitrogen fixation in Lake Winnipeg, typical bloom is 6,000 to 7,000 square kilometers these days and hangs around on the lake for 3 to 4 months. And 1969, when I surveyed the lake, the nutrients and the chlorophyll in green were down here. Since the 90s, it's really taken off. And the numbers indicate that most of that additional nutrient has come during flood years. And they've had 3 1-in-100-year floods in the last 12 years. Figure out why that might be. And then you look at the Red River Basin and how it's been channelized and how there are no wetlands left. You get a good idea. And we do other things. These are Alberta lakes. You don't reserve anything for anything in Alberta unless it's to dig up for oil sands. These are ringed with cottages, and the whole rest of the basin is agriculture. It's a recipe for certain eutrophication, and it's rampant. So some of the things we need to consider from a scientific perspective, number one, where are the First Nations supposed to get all of this fish and game and water that they were guaranteed by treaties like Treaty 8, which is the one in the oil sands area, or Treaty 6, just south of that? We need a more developed vision for the boreal to link these watersheds. It's the watershed to the lake linkages that are really important, and we can't clear-cut or mine the watershed and expect the water quality is going to go unscathed. And in fact, if you design it right on a whole watershed scale, you can use changes in water quantity and quality as an index of deterioration of ecosystem services in the watershed. It's time we had a national water strategy and policy. You know, much of what was said in the panel this morning I heard 40 years ago. And I can see, if anything, that much change in any national position on water quality. And I'm getting impatient. I want to see it before I'm pushing up daisies. We need better consideration of these green hydropower initiatives and other green initiatives in terms of impact on water and watersheds. And we can't do water protection without watershed protection. To get that done, though, we need to get both the federal and our provincial governments to stop cutting their environmental organizations. They're cut almost every year. In Environment Canada's case, they've been cut for 30, maybe 40 straight years. And it isn't the bloated hierarchy at the top that gets cut. It's the people who do the work in the field. They're the low people on the totem pole, and it's always the programs. This guy produces green glossy pamphlets, so he never gets fired. And, of course, we have zero dialogue between politicians and decision makers, and that's a recipe for falling off a water precipice. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Questions from the floor? We have time for a small number. Or has every single question you've ever had on the subject of water been answered?
Keith Heipel from University of Waterloo. Thank you for a very stimulating presentation. I understand that Premier Lougheed, former Premier of Alberta, is very concerned about the oil sands. Would you mind summarizing the way he sees the problem, if he can help?
Well, I haven't talked to him personally, but I've heard him talk in some of the same sessions, and his advice is much the same as mine. It's time to slow down and do it right. And I think anybody who's got two working brain cells and flies over that area and knows how much damage there is and how poor the ability to reclaim is, thinks, holy mackerel, we've got to get our act together on this before we keep going at this full scale. So he and also Preston Manning have been advising the government slow down. But with no provincial income tax, this is the only cow to milk. So the bigger the cow, the more the milk goes into the provincial coffers. Though whenever the cow kicks, they say, oh, it will take less milk. So it's a no-win situation.
Cameron Fenton, Dominion newspaper. I'm just wondering, a lot of people are saying that the SAGD is going to be the solution even to the water problem. I've heard claims that they're going to tap into saline groundwater aquifers or that it's somehow, but I've also at the same time that SAGD uses twice the water that even above ground extraction does. I was wondering if you could comment on that as sort of being sold as the solution.
Sure. When I was asked to put this together, to my horror, I found I had 280 slides, and there's some of the ones I've left out. My biggest objection, I think, is what they do to the surface. They like to cast this as less damaging than the mining because they don't dig a big pit. But in fact, the surface damage to the boreal forest is almost 100% in terms of effective wildlife habitat. I've got a series showing before and after development. And by the time you put in a high density of well pads, connect them with the well pipes and roads to service them and all the rest, about 50% of the watershed is gone. The density is up to 32 wells per square mile in those areas. And most of the wildlife work in northern Alberta shows that if there's any noise within 500 kilometers of a woodland caribou habitat, for example, they won't calve there and they won't rear their calves there. So there's already a big no-go zone, and woodland caribou numbers have dropped about 50%. Then there's the water issues. Right now there's a proposal by one of the biggest SAGD operations to take surface water from the Clearwater River. It's not a big amount, but it is a heritage river. The reason they need to do that is they're finding they need four times the water that they originally requested and were licensed for. And then there's the water pollution question. If you can mobilize this bitumen with all of the toxic trace metals and polycyclic aromatics in it so it can go into another pipe, what's to keep it from going into an aquifer? And I haven't heard anyone address that question to my satisfaction. And on that first slide, I showed that red area is the area that potentially they can use that. It makes the white area, huge as it is, look small. So they could destroy the surface of an area the size of Greece. And I think probably what makes me angriest of all is the fact that we guaranteed that this area would support native people with Treaty 8 in 1899, and the language is very clear. And the excuse is, well, we're taking the subsurface resource. Well, if you're destroying the surface to get that subsurface resource, I think it's a no-brainer.
Any other questions?
Well, on behalf of the entire group, everybody present, that was a tour de force. There is no one who could listen to that without becoming persuaded as to the importance of the issues that you addressed and the necessity of addressing them in a way that's so far eluded us but must be succeeded. On behalf of us all, David, thank you very much indeed. There are drinks next door.
I need one.
including rest after my prison.